You're listening to Extra Time Radio.
So, what are you guys going to do? Are you going to continue to be a bunch of soft, underperforming, tattooed millionaires?
They said all along, perfection is not possible. We just want to get the big decisions right.
What are we doing? What are we doing?
Green room getting hot.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
The right answer was a goal in Times Square so we could do butts up, but that was an easy one.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time Radio, driven by ContinentalMLSsoccer.com. I am Andrew Wiebe. In the green room, Bobby Warshaw, Matt Doyle, Taylor Twellman, your inaugural journey here with us. How does it feel? The mouse may run by your feet. If it does, please do not scream.
It's actually sitting in my pocket right now for the listeners at home. Let that go where you want.
I don't know how that happened. We have not made that sort of friendship with him. Taylor's here because it is MLS Cup week.
Oh, I thought we were going to talk golf.
Yeah.
It's usually golf.
I already took a nap today.
Lines,
I already took a nap today, so I'm good.
Good line. That's a good line. That's awesome.
I used to play a lot of golf, but that's not why we're here. Saturday, Atlanta United, the Portland Timbers, 8 p.m. Eastern, Mercedes-Benz Stadium, MLS Cup, the 23rd edition. You can watch it on Fox and Unimas here in the United States, TSN and TVA Sports in Canada. We've got the wrap coming Sunday morning. It will not be a brown liquor special. We will wake up early for you. It'll be like a hash brown, eggs, and bacon special.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Is that not – you're not okay with that or –
Matt just doesn't know why they're mutually exclusive.
No, well, first of all, that. Second of all, I was told nothing about Sunday morning, man.
Well, we will have to have a discussion then off the record. We'll lock the door to the green room.
You can talk to my agent.
And battle that one out. Look, it's a great matchup. We got Bobby Warshaw here and another Bobby coming, Bobby Boswell, to tell us about the Atlanta side of this one. Gavin Wilkinson, the GM and president of soccer at the Portland Timbers, will stop by in Seg 2. We had a long, wide-ranging conversation about how the team was built, how Diego Chará was signed, why it's so hard to find center backs in this league, and whether there'll be competition for King Jabo. He says yes, so you may not love that answer.
I mean, it's the Timbers. They got to bring in the 12th best forward from Peru and give him 3,000 minutes.
Well, we'll see what happens. Let's get right into it, guys. They said soccer couldn't work in the South. We've got Orlando. We've got Atlanta. We've got Nashville and Miami coming. We've got MLS Cup in front of 70,000. And, oh, by the way, we've got the pregame show at 6:30 p.m. Eastern on Saturday on MLS channels. They said it couldn't work. It's working. It's working just fine. Taylor, you've been in this league for a long time. You are on the cutting edge of what's happening.
I said it wouldn't work, for the record.
You said it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Why did you say that, and why do you feel you were wrong at that point?
Well, it was 180 degrees from where it was. But if you look at Atlanta as a sports town, the Atlanta Braves won 11 straight pennants. They won 14 out of 16 straight pennants, and they never sold out a regular season game. Atlanta Hawks, after they moved from St. Louis, were actually in the playoffs 10 or 11 straight consecutive seasons, never sold out a regular season game. And the Falcons were up and down. The Thrashers, as some of us are hockey fans, went in and out of that town. So I'm sitting there saying, there's no way soccer works. Now, my thought was, it's going to work if they want 14, 15,000. They're going to be the ugly stepchild of the Atlanta Falcons. Well, it was exactly the opposite. It is the only team in that town where everyone comes together, because SEC football country, right? You've got the Bama fans, the Georgia fans, the Georgia Tech fans. So it dissects the group. Everyone comes together for Atlanta United. It's that town's team, and it's only taken 2 years.
And I think the part of it is the SEC football thing, right? Like, there was, among very old people like Taylor and myself, there was this sense that soccer wouldn't work in college football country, or at least that college football country, because obviously the upper Midwest, it's worked pretty well at times. But it was that. But then the other thing is, Atlanta, more than almost any other city, is a city of transplants. And it's a new city of transplants where an Eagles fan could move to Atlanta, and they're not going to cheer for the Falcons.
No.
But they don't have those lifelong bonds with the Union. So they're going to pick up Atlanta United. And, a Yankees fan going to move to Atlanta, they're not going to cheer for the Braves, but they don't have those lifelong bonds with the MetroStars or obviously NYCFC.
Boy, you're picking the dregs here. Eagles fans, ugh. Yankees fans, ugh.
No Royals fans to speak of, though.
We don't have much
but
to
it's also
proud of.
Multicultural. It's amazing how many different countries and nationalities are represented in Atlanta, and that just has all played into the fact that Arthur Blank has hit a home run doing everything right, and it's also coincided with arguably the most gorgeous stadium this country's ever seen. So all of it's come together. I'm just surprised. For instance, we're taping this podcast right now and we're talking about it. This morning I did 92.9 The Game in Atlanta. They literally 24 months ago were taking calls saying, we're never going to talk about Atlanta United. Two former NFL guys. We're never going to do this. They've led every show in the last 3 months with Atlanta United stuff. That says it all.
They got their hand forced.
Yeah, but all four of us could sit here and say Atlanta's great, all this, blah, blah, blah. That's what resonates is when football, American football, gridiron football guys are saying, no, Atlanta, they're arguing about whether or not Franco Escobar was good enough or does Miguel Amarone want to play on turf? So a big part of that is how it's resonated in the city and not all of us in the Northeast talking about it.
So when we think about the new teams coming in, is there a lesson to be learned from Atlanta, or did they just get 10 out of 10 things perfect that actually can't be replicated?
Which team are you talking about?
Any. Nashville, Miami, Sacramento, if they come. Any new team that comes.
Well, I don't think it's a good question, Bobby. I don't think we can compare. I don't think it's apples to apples discussion. I think when you're in Nashville, you're really going to be the third show in town. You can't compare that to how Miami comes in, which is the gateway to the Latino community. You're also dealing with the Miami Heat, and you're also dealing with, is there anything to do in the summer other than go to sports games in Miami? Cincinnati? That's an interesting one because the Reds, the Bengals, they have a great opportunity of leading that community. Bobby, I don't think you can compare it apples to apples because of each situation being different.
Do we think Atlanta United has this big of a fan base if they don't spend all that money on incredible young talent?
No. If they had to write a $450 million check the way Dr. Bill McGuire did in Minneapolis, I'm not sure. They're not getting Jose Martinez. I know that. And they're definitely not getting Miguel Amarone. So now it doesn't come out. Now, they probably would have got Tata Martino, which, by the way, for the listeners, good luck to Atlanta next year. It's going to be a completely different situation, and that's why I think there's more pressure on them in the cup final. We'll get into that. But I do think, Bobby, it's interesting. I think if they wrote a $450 million check that included the stadium, I think we're talking about a different Atlanta United.
So we're going to talk about pressure. Giovanni Savarese, head coach of the Timbers, says it is all on Atlanta United. We'll talk about what this is about for the Timbers, because they already have their championship. They're on the road. Kind of feels like in some ways this is house money for them. The genius of Jose Martinez and Miguel Miron, Bobby Boswell is going to handle that with us. And we'll talk about the tactical battle, do some predictions, and talk about what it's like to lose an MLS Cup as well. Because we have Taylor Twellman here.
Might as well.
Atlanta taking an interesting tact. Arthur Blank taking an interesting tact. He says he's been texting with Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, and she is already planning a parade. That was on Wednesday. This from the city that's synonymous in sporting terms with 28-3. This from the city that hasn't won anything since 95 and really didn't win anything before that. This from the city that, as you'll find out in the mailbag, is tortured despite the fact that Bobby Warshaw thinks it's too early for them to be tortured. Was this a mistake? If I'm Arthur Blank, look, you want to plan that parade? You go ahead. I probably would not talk about it knowing the history, but at the same time, it speaks to his confidence. He knows what he built. He knows what's his home. He knows it's 70,000 people.
Yeah, but yeah, I agree.
But it's a jinx. Andrew,
yes, 100%, because Arthur Blank and his lovely missus and that entire group knows he walked onto the field in the Super Bowl about 18 to 19 minutes too soon. Right? So he's very, for a man of his age, he's very with it, and he's very up to date with everything. I'm stunned that this is public.
Yeah.
I'm honestly stunned this is public because he jumped the shark a little bit in the Super Bowl. The team loses it. To double down and do that, when easily, listen, we could all joke about 28-3 all we want. They're more of a favorite in this MLS Cup than that 28-3 scoreline in that Super Bowl, because Patriots are a much better team in relation than the Portland Timbers. For him to jump the shark, this is – I'm shocked by it.
I don't like jump the shark right here. I'm more like hop the puddle. That's the U.S. men's national team did in Cuba. They were hopping the puddle.
It's better if you create your own phrase, Bobby.
Just want to make sure.
I'm the only one who invents analogies on this show.
Yes,
okay?
But it's better because then you
Then everybody just
because then everyone thinks, how do you jump a shark?
So Giovanni Savarese said in the press conference that all the pressure is on Atlanta, and we've talked about this as it pertains to tactics, Bobby. Do you agree with Giovanni Savarese? How will that matter? Will it matter at all in this game?
Can you rephrase that question?
Can you invent the question? That's usually what you do after I ask one. You choose the question that you would like to answer, and go ahead and answer it.
I'm really fascinated by how these two teams are going to start the game because Taylor said that it is maybe the biggest – Atlanta's maybe the biggest favorite in MLS Cup history. Matt, do you agree with that?
They're up there. The more I think about it, the more they're up there.
Maybe, maybe conceptually because they're their home team and all the points, but if you really dig into the soccer on this, I do not think that Atlanta United is that big of a favorite. And this might actually be, because of the way Portland play, because of that the way that team is set up, might actually be the closest MLS Cup we've had in a few
years. You're out of your mind. Yeah. Colorado FC Dallas 2010.
That
doesn't count?
That absolutely does not count.
No, get out of here.
Did that even happen?
Houston Dynamo LA Galaxy at home. Adam Christman starting up front. Naturally, you would look at it. Robbie Keane just gets on the team. Bobby, you cannot say that this is more evenly matched.
Fair, except 2011, 2012. I'll give you that.
Like, if so 13? RSL at Sporting Kansas City, cold weather? That's almost as even as you can get it, the way Jason Christ and Garth Lagerwey brought it. Portland Timbers know exactly what they're going into. They're going into a lion's den. And there's also a reason that most of all Vegas sports odds and sports books makers are looking at it saying it's almost 7-1. Now, for someone that follows that very closely, we haven't seen 7-1 the entire playoffs.
Let me say this.
So, it conceptually is one thing, but when you look at on the field, arguably the best team this league's ever seen, and the numbers don't support that because they dropped the ball in Toronto. I don't know, man. This one's tough. This one's a tough one.
Let me phrase it this way. We all know Atlanta United doesn't like to face a bunker, and like especially a team that plays the bunker pretty regularly and pretty well. But Portland's bunker hasn't been airtight couple of weeks.
No.
Like they gave up 2 against Sporting Kansas City and could have given up 4. They gave up 3 against Seattle or 2 or 3 the 3 against 3 Seattle against and Seattle. They could have given up 4 or 5. You know, like this if that's what Seattle
FC Dallas,
Kansas
to your
City,
point could have easily scored 4 goals, but
if that's what those teams are doing, like is the eye test and the underlying numbers are matching up, eventually the box score comes around, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. I get what you're saying.
What's in it for the Timbers in this game? I mean, obviously MLS Cup, 2 in 4 years, Cascadia 4 in a row. I mean, anytime you can win this, it's a massive thing.
Know,
but
Andrew,
like, what are the stakes?
Are they an elite team if they win this?
They're not. Well, if they win this, I think they are. They're not right now. And Merritt Paulson doesn't like me for saying that on Twitter. And yeah, you know, I maybe pulled him into that argument. But no, not yet. They're not. They've been inconsistent. They've got the title that counts for a lot. But if they win it in Atlanta, and they do it this way, and this group does it, and they go to CCL, and they have another chance with Diego Chará and Valeri and Sebastian Blanco at the, not the end of their careers, but maybe the end of their primes. Absolutely, I think they are, given the fact they've won some Western conferences. But it's an incomplete resume right now for the club. I know they want to paint a different way, but it's incomplete.
I'm going to say something harsh. If you win an MLS Cup, if you win 3 in a row by sitting deep and countering, you are not an elite team.
But why is that? Whoa. Why is that?
Because being an elite team around the world demands some kind of dominance.
No, it doesn't.
Yes, it does. It demands.
Italy won the 2006 World Cup playing what way, Bobby?
Playing that way. That's fair. And sort of Greece. And we can still say that they were not.
No.
So
they were winning teams. They weren't elite teams. I'm with Bobby on this one.
So Italy's a hard one, right? Because that Italy team was very good, and the World Cup is different.
So what is your guys' definition of elite?
You need to
if a team wins 3 MLS Cups in a row, that's not elite?
That's elite in my book.
No.
As someone that's lost 3 MLS Cups in a row, our team is not elite. But let's say the Revs won 3 MLS Cups in a row. You guys we're all talking about that team. I mean, think about
legend.
7
years. You're legend.
What you're saying,
it's
legend. But like, 3 in a row is hyperbolic. I agree with that. But like, the style of play does matter, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think the idea of going out there and dominating teams, like, in no disrespect to the Timbers at all, who have they have an identity and they're good with it. They're in MLS Cup for a reason. But it's got to be more than just
so the French team that won the 2018 World Cup is not elite to you guys.
But they didn't do. They defended higher and kept more of the ball and did better things with the ball than this Portland team. And let's exclude World Cup. It's a five game tournament.
No, you guys are defining elite, and you're saying style defines elite.
Yes.
If you counter to the best in the world the way the French team did in 2018, we're going to waste this podcast. I'll disagree with you guys. I'm sorry. You could still be an elite team when you are very good at countering, explosive on the counter, on the break.
So the Timbers win this game. What does that then say about Portland? What does that say about the job Merritt Paulson and Gavin Wilkinson has done? Where do they now enter into the MLS echelon if they win this game?
When you play 30 to 50 games a year, that is different than playing six games in a summer, and you have an obligation to provide your fans and people watching with more than a boring game. Back to you.
That's the Bobby I know and love there. They win this. What does it mean? Where does Portland then enter into kind of, the echelon in MLS?
Then they get into the discussion, but to get back to that point and to what Taylor was saying before, to be an elite team, I think you need at least three trophies over the span of like 5 or 6 years, and I prefer a mix of trophies. I would like to see them win a Supporters' Shield. I would like to see them win a U.S. Open Cup. Obviously, CONCACAF Champions League, if you're the first team to win that, then almost by definition, you're an elite team. But as of right now, like this is if they win it, it's another huge, huge data point.
8 p.m. Eastern, Saturday, Atlanta United, the Portland Timbers, Fox, Unimas, TSN, TVA Sports. It's time to talk Atlanta, and let's do it with a guy who's in the locker room last year. That's Bobby Boswell. Bobby, what's up, man?
What's going on, Weeby?
Hey, man, I'm glad to have you here, and we've gone to the well. We had Paul McDonough to tell us about building this team. Now we're going to you to tell us about what it's like to be in that locker room. It's a slightly different team from last year, but not that much different. Tell me about when the trade happened, when you walked in, what you thought. How did you arrive in Atlanta, and what were your first impressions?
Well, it was night and day from D.C. to Atlanta, and that's not taking a shot at D.C. That's just maybe praising Atlanta for what they had built. And from the training grounds to, I always revert back to the personal chefs that are cooking you all your meals. And it was kind of a step up from anything I had ever seen. And, it was just an impressive thing that they had off the field. And then, once I got there, they were already playing some pretty good soccer. But upon my arrival, I think we won like 7 games, winning them all in a row, or 7 games, should have won all of them. So it was kind of an interesting transition for sure as a veteran player.
That's the Bobby Boswell effect, if I know one. You walk in there, you hit the training field, and they say, "Hey, Bobby." So mark up with Joseph Martinez. Hey, Bobby, track Miguel Miron in the open field. When you got on that training field, what was so special about these two? Could you feel it immediately?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Miguel is, there's a reason he gets so much hype. He's so fast with the ball. The biggest thing that surprised me about the way they do things in Atlanta was they work so hard as a group, but the Latin guys are the ones leading the charge, and they do borderline too much, and that might be why Tito had some injuries this year. But it's definitely a machismo mentality of whatever you throw at us, we're going to do, and we're going to do more. And Miguel, being the playmaker that he is, he still he could probably get away with taking days off and not playing every play, but he goes full throttle in practice. And Josef is just that guy's a lunatic. That's what you want in front of goal. You want a guy who's angry that he doesn't score every single time that he gets the opportunity, and that's what he was like. He was no fun to be around when he wasn't scoring, and he was a great teammate to be around when he was scoring.
Now, obviously, Portland's trying to figure out the game plan here. You had to do a little of that yourself. How did you try to mark Joseph Martinez? How did you try to stay around him? How did you try to prevent him from getting in the spaces that he wants to get in and almost always gets into, as you can see by his goal scoring record?
Yeah, I think he can go for random periods of time without being involved, and he gets frustrated. He wants to come back, but Tata's system, he has to stay high. And the idea is you know, stay where you're supposed to be and it'll eventually come. He's a world-class forward. There's no real stopping him. I think the best thing you can do is stop service, and you got to keep the ball out of those central areas. That, you know, when I played with DC, we had some success against them, just keeping them out of that middle part. We defended from the wide balls really well. And, you know, I think Portland's an interesting matchup because they can sit back and do that. They have some special players of their own up front that, you know, we saw in Kansas City the second leg where the game kind of looks like there's not much in it. And then Blanco hits a banger and all of a sudden they're flying. So they can do the same thing to Atlanta. If they can sit back and poach a goal early, I think they have, you know, a pretty good chance. But if the longer the game goes 0-0 and Atlanta gets that momentum, I think it'll be tough for them on the night.
You talked about Tata's approach. Walk me through what you learned when you got there. What is his approach in your mind?
I mean, you know, I tweeted something that got a lot of traction, and it was all, people were all over the place saying that, oh, he had a competitive advantage by violating the rules. Like, he's not the only coach. He's not the only team I've ever played for that didn't give days off. And to be honest, players don't really care about that stuff. You always want to come in and be professional and do your regen and stuff. So that was a misconception. For me, Tata is not the only coach that does tactical training. And you know, there's rumors that Berhalter is even more tactically advanced than the way Tata does things. But the thing I was impressed with was he was very cerebral with his group of coaches. They were all on the same page. When they did a drill, they all had some kind of influence on it. It was all about, you know, they had real defined lines with how they marked fields out and what they wanted to achieve in it. And, you know, it was all about giving options and making the right decision and putting the ball in spaces where it gives a guy an advantage. It was, you know, an incredible thing to see the way that they operated as a group. And, you know, you say, well, that's the group, that's not Tata, but Tata built that group. And those guys are so loyal to him, and they all buy into what he believes. And once he got the players on board to buying in, then that's where the real success happened.
71 points for the Red Bulls, Bobby. 69 for Atlanta United. And look, in the green room here, we made a big deal about them choking it out on the final day of the regular season against Toronto FC. But as these playoffs have gone on, and as they've done what they've done and pushed past the Red Bulls and give them more to cry about, it's kind of crystallized that this is probably, maybe, we're still trying to figure it out, the best team in MLS history. You've seen a lot of good teams. You've been on a lot of good teams. When you watch this team this year, is this, in your mind, the best team in MLS history?
I don't know. That's such a loaded question. I think that Atlanta United has underperformed, and part of that is, you know, not to take, I think what the Red Bulls did was amazing. I think they got the most out of what they could do, whereas I think Atlanta could have done more. But having been in that environment, I think every team that goes and plays Atlanta, because they have the ability to put five up on you, I think Atlanta got everyone's best the whole year. And, you know, there are a lot of games that they left points out there, and they should have, you know, they should have won, as you'd say. But I definitely think that they play a very attractive style of soccer. They've got a very special set of guys that are high IQ players, not just foreign, but the American guys that they do have. They've got some young studs as well. And Julian, you know, I'm not sold on Barco yet, but maybe in the future. But the real difference makers are the Almirones and the Martinez guys and the Tito Villalbas, even though he's not even starting. They are a special group, but, you know, you're judged by your results. And right now they haven't gotten any hardware, and that's a team that should be sporting some hardware. So if they go out and win the MLS Cup, maybe we can have that conversation. But if they don't get it done, they're a good team on paper, and that's it.
At Bobby Boswell on Twitter. Bobby, before I let you go, it's always story time with you, man. I need a story from Atlanta, something that sticks out, something that you tell the people when they ask you about your experiences.
Yeah, I'll give you one, and it's a Tata story. It was my first week joining the team. We had a video session, and the guys were all complaining because these things apparently went too long. They just played Kansas City. Jacob Peterson had scored a goal late in the game to tie it up. And we watched this video session, and the first thing they go after is Julian. They talk about he's making these weird, crazy cross-field runs, and most people think those look like good runs. And he's saying, under my system, I don't want you to do that. He could sense that Julian didn't appreciate it. He says, okay, let me show you Real Madrid clips to show some clips of some guys doing what he wants from Real Madrid. And he says, okay, maybe Real Madrid's not a good example. They queue up a Bundesliga clip and they show that. So it's like, I'm thinking, wow, this is impressive. This young kid's getting this development. Then he shows a play where Miguel, he flips the ball over the holding midfielder. You know, it's a nice little rainbow. They create a chance, almost score a goal. And he says, is this a good play? We all say, of course. He says, this is not what I want. I don't want you flipping the ball over. Jeff Larinowicz has shown he's right there in front of you. Just pass him the ball. Let him look at the field. I don't care if you can do this. That's not what I'm asking you to do. Then he shows clips of different teams from around the world, different leagues of guys just playing simple soccer, moving into space, opening up. And it was just an incredible thing, you know, where he goes from helping the young guy on the team to calling out the best player on the team for doing an amazing play and saying, I don't want you guys doing what you want to do. I want you doing what I want you to do. And if you believe in that it'll work. And, you know, I just think that kind of shows what kind of coach he was. And, you know, a lot of guys, you know, if you're not playing there, you're probably not very happy. You don't agree with it. But I think those guys that are there, they're very lucky to have, you know, have him there as a coach and to be taught things that they have. And, you know, that story is it was one of the most impressive video things I've ever seen. And it was just a simple Tuesday, like they probably do it every week now. So he's a great coach. And, you know, I think that he deserves a lot of the credit he's given. He deserves a lot of the hype he's given. And hopefully Atlanta goes out. I'm pulling for those guys. I hope they win. I love Larry, but I hope Atlanta gets it done this weekend.
And Tata, they trust in Atlanta. 70,000 plus going to show up for this game, 8 p.m. on Saturday. Fox, Unimas in the U.S., TVA Sports, TSN in Canada. At Bobby Boswell on Twitter. Go there. You get all the anecdotes. You get all the jokes, all the stories. Bobby, everything good? We hope it is. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
All right, thanks, bud. I appreciate you having me on.
Big thanks to Bobby Boswell for joining us here. Go follow him on Twitter. He's got the one-liners. Yeah, he's got a lot of those. So go check him out there. Look, there's some news around both of these guys right now, both Joseph Martinez and Miguel Amarone, and I'm not talking about the Landon Donovan MVP award. Joseph Martinez says he said it before. He's going to stay in Atlanta as long as they want me. On the flip side, the rumors are Miguel Marone's on his way to Newcastle in the English Premier League on loan for $19 million with a purchase option there. Which of those do you want to start with? Joseph Martinez?
The loan is not happening.
No loan.
Someone close to the situation confirmed that to me today, which is good. I'd be shocked if the loan happens.
Tenorio's reporting that as well. I just don't see any reason for them to accept sending him out on a loan. It's got to be a full purchase or nothing.
Unless that you want to risk maybe seeing if Miguel Amarone does well and you keep his rights. Because I still think there's major question marks of whether Almiron succeeds in England, and maybe you risk that. But from what I'm hearing and what I heard in England in November when we were there, it was 23 to 26 million plus. Loan was not part of the equation.
And by the way,
that's a lot of money to
Newcastle
me.
United right now is about to be sold as well. So this could end up, and it looks like it's going to be an American buyer. So this could end up being a splash in two markets, which is another reason to think the deal absolutely will get done as soon as January comes around.
Joseph Martinez says he'll stay as long as Atlanta want him. What do you make of those comments? Because I think he's underpaid.
Well, duh.
But I think he's underpaid. So
but do any of us in this room know exactly what he's being paid?
That's a good point.
No. Well, the Players Union says it's 1.7.
Right. Yeah. Right, so we can have that discussion at a later time. I think Atlanta, if they're smart about their business, they make Joseph Martinez the face of their franchise for the next 5 to 6 years, and here's why. Goal scoring resonates no matter what fan you are of what team. And so as you're building your brand, if you've got a guy that's going to score you 20-plus goals in 5 straight years and be that guy and be the face and hit the Spanish and English market, it's an absolute home run. It's a no-brainer. However, they're going to have to pay him. And as of right now, I'm not sure they're going to pay him. I think they're going to make him work a little bit more, but in my opinion, he should be top three highest-paid players in the league.
I mean, the season he's had, it's hard to argue with that.
Last time I heard was that he really had his heart set on going to Europe, that he really feels like he can prove that he can play with the best strikers in Europe, and he wants to get back to Italy. Probably not Italy this time. I think he was a little more intent on going to Spain, but proving that he can be a Champions League striker.
I mean, I don't blame him if he wants to do that, but the other thing is, like, if you're getting paid $5 million a year to score 30 goals a year in front of 70,000 fans 34 weeks a year, like, that's a pretty good job. Yeah, that's pretty good. Like, and the other thing is, like, if he was Argentinian, he would need to go to Europe to break into that national team. He's not. He's Venezuelan. And granted, there is a little bit of a logjam at center forward there, but he's still going to get looks with that. Like, he's going to be at the Copa America next year.
I'm always concerned with paying goal scorers like that. And Taylor, you can speak to this a little better, but you need a carrot at the end of the stick. Whether that carrot is to be paid or more likely to get to Real Madrid one day, you need that reason to play at 100% in training, to play at 100% in games, to fight through adversity. And I think if you take the carrot of Europe away, or if he says no to that, and you give him the carrot of money, then will he still be the same wonderful SOB Joseph Martinez that we know and love every single day?
So what was Zlatan's carrot? What was Robbie Keane's carrot? What is Didier Drogba's carrot? What's Wayne Rooney's carrot?
My answer to that is, when you're a little bit older, you're fighting for your legacy. It's, you have a different perspective.
Robbie Keane didn't come over here when he was 38. Came over here when he was 31.
Which is different.
The carrot to play in a World Cup, and he showed up every single year scoring goals. So what's the carrot? Joseph Martinez still wants to qualify for a World Cup with Venezuela. Whether he's getting paid $5 million or $1.7 million, I don't know if I agree with you on that. More often than not, goal scorers are very fickle human beings, and if you do make them happy, who knows what kind of player you get. I think Joseph Martinez, whether he's on $5 million or $300,000, is still going to be an SOB because he lives and dies by scoring goals. He is currently trying to negotiate a contract. So whatever that notion of going to Europe, he wants it now. In Atlanta, if you're smart about your business, do you really want to get rid of Tata Martino, who recruited him to go there? You don't know who your next manager is, and then he shows up, or she, whoever they hire, and now Joseph is upset, and you didn't get him to sign that new deal. I think Atlanta's offseason, I think it's more important to get Joseph Martinez signed to a new deal than it is about the new manager.
There's some tiptoeing they got to do very, very soon, but right now it's all about Saturday. Tactically, there's been a lot of talk coming into this game about how two sides might cancel each other out with similar tactics. How do we see this playing out? You're the armchair analyst. You're wearing hot dog socks. Therefore, we start with you. Oh, by the way, this hot dog is dressed in the right way, except for the ketchup, which is a sin.
But it does kind of match the shirt, so I'm it's okay.
Take off the ketchup, get some relish, give me the tactical side to this one.
Come on now.
Such a Midwestern boy over there with the relish.
Maybe a little bit of onions.
I think that, man, now I want a hot dog.
Yeah.
I think that Bobby had it right, that we all know Portland's going to come out and they're going to sit deep. And the only question that I have about them is, do they go in the 4-5-1 so they get the extra man in midfield to deny service, or, you know, at the origin, or do they get the extra man in the defense, go 5-4-1, get another guy around Joseph and try to deny service in the box, which is...
So if they play five in the back, this is for you two, who plays there?
That's the thing. I mean, we've seen Tuiloma come in and do a decent job. We know that Ridgewell, if he doesn't have to run, is still a good defender in this league. Mabiala hasn't practiced this week, from what I understand. That said, they've had him off to the side, and they're making noises about him being available.
Whether he's available or not, you guys know this. You can't start him, because if he hurts his ankle 10 minutes in, you've just wasted
Burned a sub. So it's... Those are the three guys, because Cascante fell out of the lineup around early September, and you're not going to play him. So it does seem like a 4-5-1 that's going to be in a deep block.
It'd be if they do that, I think it'd be a 4-4-2. I think Valeri would partner Bobasi and do the two lines of four with the two strikers blocking the entry passes into the center mid. So just a small...
I mean, I get that, because if you look at the way Valeri has played, he's at times... Mm-hmm. Huge chunks of times, almost a second forward. Mm-hmm. The question in this game is how does Tata handle it? He's played a million different formations this year. They haven't been a high pressing team in 2018, but I think they still have that in the bag. They were a really good high pressing team in 2017, but in these playoffs, they have been primarily a counter-attacking team. I think that was a wrinkle specifically for the New York teams. And I think once, you know, in the first 5 minutes, they realized, oh, the Red Bulls aren't going to press us in that first leg. They said, oh, we'll just play like we always play. We'll carry the ball 60% of the time. We'll bring guys up. We'll get both wing back, because they were playing them 5-3-2. We'll get both wing backs way up high. Escobar ended up playing almost as a winger. So it was, I think there's a lot. I think that there's a lot that Tata can do with this, and because a number of his guys are so multifunctional, he could take that 5-3-2, come out with it, and inside 10 minutes, it's a 4-3-3.
But you guys know this as well as anyone. Formations isn't tactics.
Right, but they are married.
They're married, but your tactics is more of your philosophy, yeah. Right? So whether it's a 4-4-2, a 4-5-1, it doesn't matter. The reality is this. You're going to defend with numbers behind the ball. You're given a license to Diego Valeri, and he's also going to give a license, Giovanni Savarese, to Sebastian Blanco.
Yeah.
So Blanco, as good as he's been, the reality is he's been better when Gio and his staff have said, you don't have to worry about defending as much as we think we want the other team to think. So even though you're deeper, the moment the ball bypasses your line, get out of there. So he's their number one counter option more than Diego when you look at how they break the lines.
Yeah.
For Gio, it's one thing. Alves Power is Eric Valentin. I think my Biala's injury, he can't play five in the back because he's not fit and you can't risk that. So he's going to play the same lineup, but the option is Valentin or Alves Power.
Yeah.
Remember, he started Powell against Seattle, right? That's a different task. Miguel Almiron loves to come there. I think because of the momentum of that victory in leg two, I think he plays the same lineup, and I think it's a massive risk.
Well, he subbed Valentin off at the end to bring Pal on when Gerso came on.
No, because he was on a yellow, and he should have got a second yellow.
For
if
sure.
But if he was on a yellow, Gio told me he wouldn't have brought him
on. Okay, that's good information.
So when you think about how Portland's going to play, it's going to be the same lineup, same formation as Sporting Kansas City, but Blanco's the key for them. Because with where Eric Remedy plays and how he looks at a game, if you're going to force Diego Valeri all the way to the touchline to the right or left, you've already won the battle. Mm-hmm. It's when he plays underneath Obobese, Remedy's key for that because he ain't moving.
No.
He's not going anywhere. His sole purpose is the width of the 18s, which I think has been understated with what Tata's done. Mm-hmm. Whether Tata plays 5-3-2, 3-5-2, 4-5, it doesn't matter. It's all about them believing that they're going to have more possession, and that's why I don't think it's that much of a change for them. You hit the nail on the head. They changed for both New York teams. They did.
By the way, said that. Greg Berhalter is in this studio saying, I was shocked to see the Red Bulls not press me in leg one of ours. He said, we thought we were going to get run ragged, and we were fine. Didn't have an issue with it. How does this game look aesthetically?
Well, remember, Berhalter played Patrick Mullins thinking that they were going to play very direct, and he played Zardes in a wide channel, and that changed it.
One small way that the formation does matter for the tactics in this one, if Tata sticks with the five defenders and the three center backs, when you play that formation, it ensures you always have at least four behind the ball, because you mentioned that Remedy always stays there. So instead of risking having two center backs from 80 and maybe both outside backs flying forwards, you only have three behind the ball defending the counter. If you do stick with the five defenders, you always have four. So that is one small way that the formation ensures a stylistic preference.
Is this
what do you mean? Yeah.
To go back to the aesthetic side, we are deep in the weeds, and I love getting there. Is this going to be a fun game to watch?
No.
That's what people are thinking
about.
It's
going to be fun for the people in the room here. But I don't – like, I was talking to Stu Holden earlier in the week. I was talking to – you know, I think I talked with Alexi about it. Like, this is going to be a super cagey game, right? Unless Atlanta get an early goal.
In which case,
then it opens right
up. The first 25 minutes, good luck. Good luck to Portland Timbers. And anyone that has an issue with saying that, that's the reality. If Atlanta gets a goal in the first 15 minutes, this one could be over quickly. Listen, we all watched the Red Bulls all year long, and I called leg one, and I was stunned at that result because of the way they played. It can overwhelm you, 70,000 in the moment. Even as good as Portland's been on the road, none of them have been in that environment. The only positive for Portland compared to all the other teams, they're a turf team. So the turf's not going to have an impact on it. Well, the turf actually had an impact on the Red Bulls and New York City. It's not going to bother Portland that much, but if there's no early goal, we're talking about one of the ugly finals.
The way that it might be aesthetically pleasing is I do think that this will be a game won by spectacular moments. In the same way that Blanco scored an incredible goal with Almiron, Joseph, and the way this game is cagey, it's not going to be some well-worked goal. It's going to be a player getting the ball and on a free kick or a moment of magic doing something spectacular, lights Twitter up.
Both goals were crap June 24th when these two teams
were just like bouncing around. slamming your foot into it, hoping it goes in the back of the net. I think Mabiala in that game scored, and yep. the Julian Gressel on kind of a cleanup job. We'll get to predictions in half second here. One team will win, one team will lose. You know that whole cliche, Taylor.
Yeah.
What's it like this week, first of all, the buildup, and then what's it like to be on the wrong end of these results? And you did it. I went back and like watched all the highlights for yours.
I did it in every possible way.
Oh, my God. So. They're just all stomach punches. There's yeah. not one of them that's like, ah, you know what? We got blown off the field.
2002 was the not the hardest, because we had to win six of our last seven regular season games to get into the playoffs. We did that. We ended up winning the Eastern Conference. You end up playing seven postseason games because you're playing Sunday, Wednesday, Sunday, and then you hosted it at the end, right? 2002, we had honestly no business being there. So then you host 62,000 people there. You lose in front of your home fans. That's difficult, but LA was the better team unequivocally. 05, 06, and 07, you don't get over those. Because when you look at those teams, the way we were built, the way we went through the regular season, we were dominant, we were dangerous, we were good, especially in the playoffs. Nobody could beat us. And yet in the final, 05, we lose on a golden goal. 06, FIFA changes the rules to golden goal, so we don't win on a golden goal.
That you
and we
score.
Give up a goal 18 seconds later, then lose on penalties, which, by the way, if our media was really strong at that point. There's an interesting backstory. We'll never give that to that penalty kick shootout that would blow U.S. soccer Twitter sphere out of the water.
All right, investigative journalists, get out
and
there.
And then 07, we have our best final. We throw caution to the wind. We don't care. We've already lost three. Nothing matters. And you go in the 07 final in the first half, we should have been winning 4-0. And we don't. It's hard to explain how you it's still the one thing that I always think about for the Revs fans. It's the one thing that stands with you. And national media won't talk about it. This is massive for Michael Parkers. Michael Parkers loses this final would be the first player in MLS history to lose five MLS Cups and not win one. So that resonates massively for him and with everyone. So you look at it, it sucks. But on the other hand, we got to four finals. You know, that's one of the things that we fought through a lot. We were primarily an American team with Shalvey Joseph, who grew up in New York, Avery John, who was basically an American. Our team resonated with a lot of U.S. soccer fans because so many of us represented, but we just didn't get the job done, plain and simple.
What's that feeling on the field, final whistle blows? Try to share with
people.
Well,
they're different. Every year it was different
for
because
sure.
I'm like, oh, again? Oh, again? And then finally, the fourth one, I was like, of course, naturally, we would lose.
Yeah.
You reflect on it. You don't sleep. You think about what happens. You think about what you could have done. You just go through everything. But ultimately, you feel bad for the fans because of, you know, we didn't. This was before MLS gave you home playoff games, home cup games. So we were in Dallas for two of them. All those fans came down. And 07, people don't remember this. The Kraft family skipped the New York Jets versus Patriots game to all fly down. They all flew down to RFK. Like, that was a massive moment post-game. And that's your fourth one. I will say this. After 07, we all kind of knew it was over. Because you just kind of knew, you know what? This thing's done and dusted. But it's a sickening feeling. I still talk about it to this day.
I
remember it like it was yesterday.
Yeah, I think back to the Jermaine Jones team that went to Cup after winning that, talking to the Crafts, what they had to say, the feelings that they had, and then also seeing after that game them taking off from StubHub Center to go to a Patriots game. There's a lot at stake here for both sides. We'll see what happens. Our predictions happen right now. Who wins this thing?
Atlanta?
Anybody going to go against the grain?
Nah, it's Atlanta.
Bobby wants to, but he can't.
I can build a case, and I think it's closer than they think it is, but yeah, safe money's on Atlanta.
God, you're such a pander to Atlanta fans. Why don't you just move
there? Are you going to do this right now? Are you going to do this?
I think he's doing it. I think it's time for us to go to the break, so I'm with you as well. Atlanta United are probably champions, which means come Sunday morning.
Portland wins up penalties.
Exactly. Come Sunday morning, Matt will be hating me. I'll be bribing him with different
what
breakfast meats.
What time are we seriously talking?
6:30, 7. I have a 9 o'clock flight, so we got to do it early. I'm just kidding. I have a late afternoon flight I've booked just for you. The look on his face was priceless.
If Portland win, are you still invited to Merritt's private party?
What do you mean still? I don't think I'm on Merritt's list.
By the way, we knew Atlanta was going to win because Dave Goss, Andrew Wiebe.
You're on another list, but don't worry.
Rhymes with spit. No, I'm just kidding. All right, we'll go to break. On the other side, Gavin Wilkinson.
Fans We want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email extratime@mlssoccer.com or tweet at Extra Time Radio with any comments, questions, or reactions.
The winner takes it all. The loser standing small. Beside the victory.
Back now on Extra Time Radio, driven by Continental. Andrew Wiebe in the green room. Portland Timbers GM and president of soccer, Gavin Wilkinson, on the line ahead of yet another MLS Cup. Gavin, the second in 4 years. But we had to delay this a little bit. I'll take a little bit of the blame. Had to pick up the kid from daycare. On your side, your voice was going. That is terrible timing. How you feeling? Everything good to go?
Feeling a little bit better, but the voice is still struggling, so bear with me. But I'm glad it worked out for everyone.
What's the Wilkinson way to cure a sore throat? Every family has their different remedies. Are you like a tea and honey guy? Where'd you go with this?
Just Lemsip. A lot of Lemsip at the moment. Just trying to keep plowing through. Obviously, it's a busy week with juggling a lot of different things, getting ready for the Cup.
So we see all the options coming out. Your team is preparing for Cup. We haven't seen who's staying and who is going. That's for a reason. How do you spend this week? Because you have the hoopla that everybody else is engaging in, but you still have a job to do.
Yeah, I think a lot of the preparation for the off-season still. Obviously, we've got our targets that we need to focus on. So it's juggling a lot of staff. It's juggling a lot of priorities. The main one is obviously MLS Cup, but then it's very quick as far as the turnaround. I think the staff will get a couple of weeks off and then be reporting for the MLS draft, MLS combine, and then draft. So for us, it's a matter of getting the players sorted for next year. It's a matter of making sure that the players in Portland are focused on the game, making sure that the families are looked after, making sure that they don't see any of the chaos behind the scenes. So, you know, that we've got a lot of good staff and everyone's pitching in. So it's keeping people busy.
Do you still live within walking distance of the stadium?
No, that was a short-term solution while I was trying to keep my job. So, you know, the good news is I still own that property, but no longer within walking distance.
I remember having that conversation with you and you talking about how much time you spent working, trying to get things where you needed to get them. And then I think back to all the time you've spent with this club. I mean, it's almost two decades at this point, going back to 2001 as a player. What does the Portland Timbers at this point represent to you? Because it feels like it's just this, from the outside, this huge, huge, overwhelming part of your life.
Yeah, I would say if you ask my family that question, it's part of everyone's life in the family. So, you know, generally the conversations are around the Timbers, they're around the Thorns, and I'm lucky that both the kids play the game and enjoy the game, and my wife, I believe, tolerates it and mainly enjoys it. But for me, it means the world, obviously, to see a club go from the USL era to MLS and have a little bit of success. It justifies a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of work that everyone's put into it. So, and more from a personal standpoint, I always joke that it's a rented position in professional sports, that you have to keep defying logic to stay in a club this long. And the objective is to defy logic and see if I can last longer and be successful.
Another chance to win a title. We talked a lot about Atlanta on this show all year long. It's because they're new, they're shiny. Tell us about your project. Where does it stand right now? How did you get here? How did you build it? How would it hit in ways you thought it would and maybe in ways you thought it wouldn't?
I think every single club starts off with, we want to win an MLS Cup, and then they have their strategy and they have their way about it. And for us, I think we reinvented the club halfway through 2012. Going into 2013 changed what we wanted the club to become. And again, that's in the USL days, we were known as a very frugal club, one that was professional, one that worked hard, one that pretty much got results, not always in a great fashion, but it was successful, and it was a matter of making sure that the organization was sustainable. A lot of the finances back in the USL was based on exhibitions, based off camps, making things work. And then going into, obviously, towards the end of the USL, when Merit purchased it, it changed, and we started to create a vision. That vision, as I said, towards 2013 was altered. We wanted to become a lot more specific. We wanted to become a lot more data-driven and base ourselves on some of the teams that were successful at that time while continuing to evolve. And for Merritt, he's invested a ton of money, and it's got to be a product that he can relate to. It's got to be a product that excites him. And luckily, and we've been able to do that. I think we have become a lot more focused on the collective, and that when we brought in Caleb in 2013 and the staff that was with Caleb, I think everyone played a massive part in the club's success going into 2015. And every time we fail, as 2014, 2016, we make sure we don't make the same mistakes. So it's been an evolution.
What has Atlanta done in 2 years from your perspective? You're so intimately involved on your end. It's your profession in a lot of ways, as you said, you and your family's life. When you watched Atlanta do this in 2 years, what they've done, what stands out to you?
It's just truly, I think everybody would say the same things. What they've done is remarkable. Darren Eales, I think Carlos and Paul McDonough, when he was involved, the team that they've put together, the product that they've assembled, it's not easy. And to do what they've done, I think you've got to take your hat off to them. It truly is remarkable. And while it is a different model from us, they've spent very wisely. And I think with the support that they've got, with the infrastructure, with the training facilities, they have set the bar for MLS. And I think it's healthy. I think it's great to have these teams in the league. And I think it's great for the ownership to drive it this way. So for me, I think it's remarkable what they've done. They've got a great balance of foreign players that have come in, accepted their role. And there's some foreign players that have taken the league by storm. And then you've got some quality additions, American additions at that, that have been the platform for success. And we lost a very good player in Darlington Nagby to them. But they had a plan. They went about it. They acquired him. And they followed it through. So to be in your second year, and apologize about my voice, but to be in your second year and to be this successful, but to follow on from last year, it is remarkable.
How have they maybe changed the league? How have they changed the job that you do? And not just them, but the change in resources and expansion, the change in the available markets for players and now seemingly for coaches. How has the league changed in the last couple of years from your point of view?
I think the spend, first and foremost, I think the willingness to go and spend $15, $16 million on a player. And for that player to be sitting on the bench for Atlanta is another part of the story. But the willingness to spend and the willingness to spend to win, I think it drives every other owner to say, are we doing it the right way? Every other GM to say, how can I use this money more effectively? And the money that they have spent starts to put us on the world stage a little bit more. So first of all, there's that. Then there's the infrastructure, the facilities, I think. What they're providing players on a day-to-day basis, what they're providing the team, and the way that they're going about it, again, has raised the bar. So you're looking at the investment in players, the quality of the games, it's drastically affected by the spend. But when you go to their training facilities, again, it's another feather in their hat that they're just doing things the right way. And for us, we look at them. I came back with a lot of photos of Atlanta and what they were doing with their training facility, and to be fair, try and implement some of them. So it's a great thing for all of us. As I said, it's raised the bar, and I'm sure they'll continue to do so.
You know, Gavin, one of the places I think that I've been most struck in the last couple of years is the quality of coaching. Not that it was poor before. I'm not saying that. It's more about the ability to recruit outside and then the opportunities given to coaches within this league. You see a Jesse Marsh, now a Greg Berhalter, Tata Martino, rumored to go to the Mexican national team. Of course, his profile is what it is. Patrick Vieira moving over to Nice after starting his career in New York City. It's not just the players that are changing this league. How have you seen coaching change, and why did Gio Savarese fit into that mold for you and the club?
So for us, I'll touch on the geo part first. It was interesting. We started to overlay all of the metrics, the way the team played, and the style, the system, the philosophies, and then try to map that with what we had done previously under Caleb for 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, and try to find similarities. We had an experienced group, and I didn't want too many things to change relative to how we use some of those pieces and some of the players that we had. That they're proven, they're experienced, and they're quality. So for us, we're with Gio, what he did with the Cosmos, even though you could argue it was a different level, it was very interesting in how he managed the players, how he worked with the players, and the end results. And the end results being day-to-day on the training field, the games, and the end results being that he won trophies. So for us, with Gio, with his background as a person, everything we found out about him through the interview process, it started to build a level of confidence that we were making the right decision. And I think we were questioned 5 games in, what were we doing? Did we know what we were doing? And at the moment, you'd have to say it looks good, but it is an evolution for all of us. So we gave Gio the bandwidth to make mistakes, and I think it's important. But one of the things you see within his growth is the ability to manage high-profile players going from the Raul's to, again, coming in and managing the current league or previous MVP in Diego Valeri. It was interesting to see the way that he worked with the players, and he understands the direction of the Timbers and is willing to absorb that while still putting his own stamp on it. So for us, that was very interesting about Gio. And just his ability at the highest level to earn respect. So with Gio, that's one thing. But as you said, the bar has risen. And when you start looking at the quality of the coaches and the quality of the games and all the metrics associated with it, coaching has definitely shifted. And I believe, even with the Federation introducing the pro license and understanding there needs to be growth there, the introduction of the Tatars, Greg Burles has done amazing. Jesse Marsh has gone overseas. But they have helped the game tremendously in this country. I find the games are a lot more tactical. There's a lot more, you know, adjustment of tactics. There's a lot more system changes. So for us, it's an evolution, and I think it's helped the league in a massive way.
Diego Chará is a guy that can sometimes disrupt tactics all on his own. I love watching him in the open field. I love the moment after he takes a ball off somebody that you think he can't take, and then all of a sudden he's 20 yards the other way. I want you to go all the way back, though, because we give the other Diego Valeri, so much love, and his story has been told so many times. I'm not sure I've ever heard from you the discovery, the signing, the progression, the connection that you have with Diego Chará.
So for me, going back, it was 2010. I was with John Spencer, actually. We were traveling through Colombia. For us, just collecting information on all players, basically watching as many games as possible, starting to see what was available, players that we liked, etc. And we sat separately at the games to see which players we liked. And this was one that just for us, there was a game, Tolima versus Millonarios, that I just won't forget. And Diego Chará, we were joking afterwards that the player should be drug tested. The player has three lungs. We should look at him. Why is he still in this league? How's he not moved? So then it started the conversations with just the club. More merit to say, what is our bandwidth to spend on a holding midfielder? A position that previously in the league, nobody had really gone out and said, this is a DP. This is a DP position. So for us, it was a matter of trying to find out the bandwidth. Merritt said, these are the funds that I can give you. And we went back to Colombia, watched Diego Chará probably live another 3-4 times, and started conversations with the club, started to find out a little bit more about him and his family. And, you know, to say that there was an appreciation and a love of the player immediately, the first time we saw him, it would be true. But then that grew. And then it became a situation where this is a player that we must have. And I remember going to Merritt saying, this is a player that we can build around for a long, long time. And when you start to look at, we paid, I believe, 1.7. When I say we, it was Merritt. We paid $1.7 million for him. And, you know, when you start to amortize that over the number of years that he's been with the club, he's paid us back 10 times. And he is, for me, a player that is very, very difficult to replace in this league. He does all the dirty work, but again, on the ball, he's very comfortable. The level of respect that he gets from his teammates is second to none.
Do you think it's a requirement to have that dominant defensive midfielder in order to get to and win MLS Cup? If you go back through the winners in this league the last 6, 7, 8 years, Michael Bradley, Ozzy Alonso before that. I mean, as you go back through it, I can't list them all now. It's a consistent factor. You almost have to have this position.
Yeah, but it's also the – agreed, but – it's the mentality that the players that you've mentioned bring. They are winners. And they have the respect of their locker room. They have the respect of everybody involved in the game. They bring something. They do the work that not many players want to do. And Chará relishes it. You see him track a player 60 yards, make a tackle, turn around and go the other way and smile. He takes great joy in those aspects of the game. And the players that you've mentioned take great pride in that position and the way that it's played. And to me, it is a common factor, but again, I would go back to the personality and the profile of the individual. For us, you know, we will not have been in two MLS Cups without Diego Chará. So to give him the credit that he deserves is just, and You know, I think people around the league recognize that as well.
Do you feel how do you feel when you see that split? Have you seen it, the one that goes around every time he misses a game and you guys either tie or lose, where it's basically every game the Timbers win, Diego Chará's in the lineup, and the games that you don't, he's not?
Yes. Yep. So how I would answer that is I believe Diego is now paying the other players to actually keep that streak alive. And he wants to build his legacy, but it just shows his importance. He is, for us, you know, we keep talking about succession plans within the club. And I said last week, I think we just have to ride him for as long as possible. We do think he's got 2-3 more years in him, the way that he plays. He has an older brother that played till he was 36, and it's just in the family. So for us, we need to make sure that that isn't a continuing trend, that we can actually find midfielders that operate together and help the team in a way that, that Diego helps the team. And it is a focal point for us.
A free bit of, I don't want to call it advice, but on this show we speculated that Diego Valeri gets a statue, and about 5 yards behind it, you put up a statue of Diego Chará tackling the ball off somebody. So just a suggestion. You do with that as you will.
I think that's probably a fair assumption, by the way.
All right.
That we will be putting in 2 statues for those guys.
2 Diegos. Can't do one and not the other. We've talked about Valeri so much in the past. He's my dad's favorite player. But I want to talk to you about Jeremy Obobese, because he's a guy who I think a lot of us wondered when would get his opportunity. You had Fernando Adi, you had Samuel Armenteros, and then he comes in and it's his job, and he puts his hands around it and he's taking it. What have you seen from him? Is this still a position that you think you need to reinforce in as you work towards this winter?
For me, the biggest thing with Jeremy is, I think, maturity, responsibility. The things that he's showing now, he's always been capable of. I think it's not with everybody, but with a couple of young players that are coming through the system, they get a lot of credit very, very quickly within their careers. And with Jeremy, he was coming in as a high draft pick. He had done well with the youth national teams, and it really was the first time that he had been in a professional environment like this and had to actually earn his paycheck on a week-to-week basis and the ability to have a career. And I think it finally dropped with Jeremy after, I think Gio had several meetings with him, spent hours with him on the training field after trainings, just working with him. And for him, he could see that he had the opportunity. I think previously when we had Adi, when, you know, Armenteros was performing, Jeremy accepted the role that he could be third. When we moved Adi, Jeremy suddenly thought, you know what, if I do a little bit more, if I work a little bit harder, I could actually have this position. And to his credit, he did it. And he's doing well for the team. He's a complimentary piece, but he's also a very good number 9. And then will we look to reinforce this position? We have to. And that's for Jeremy's benefit, and that's for the club's benefit, to find another good number 9 that can put Jeremy under pressure, give us a different look. That Milana gives us a different look than Jeremy, I think is important for the club.
What does it take to sign that center forward? And I'm talking about the top tier kind, because we sit in this green room after that series against Sporting Kansas City, and we said, hey, look, if they just had that player to finish, and it's been the narrative with them for a while now, and sure, if Gutierrez does it, then we're not talking about this, but he didn't, so we are. You're one of those guys that has to go out and sign that player. How hard is it to actually do that?
Extremely. It's one that you either spend a lot of money to guarantee, and that's based on somebody that's 26, 27, that's done it for the previous 5-6 years, and that's as close to a guarantee as you can get. And those players aren't cheap. Those players don't come out of contract very often, and they're not cheap. You know, if you start to look at a price between 2 and 4, 4.5 million, a little bit of it is prospecting. You're going to try and get somebody either at the end of their career, or you're trying to get somebody 20, 21, that hasn't taken off yet, and you're paying a little bit for potential. So it's a tough one to get right. And then you've got to start to look at how do they fit into the dynamics of the team? What is their role within the team? And obviously every club's different, but when you start to spend that much money, you can't get it wrong. And, you know, years ago, there was a price that was thrown out about what we paid for Milano. And, you know, while it was close, we were paying for potential. And he's back with the club now, and he's doing extremely well. But you go one of two directions, and we decided to go younger, and we may do that again. But there is a risk factor associated with that.
one of the other places I've seen a lot of money spent recently, and I'm talking more on the TAM side, but you guys have a DP center back, is that central defender spot. And it just seems like everyone wants and needs a dominant center defender or two in this league. Yep. But so many teams have found it very hard to sign that player via TAM. Why do you think that is? As a former defender yourself, as someone who's in this market, you got Mabiala, you've got Liam Ridgewell. How do you find that player? What attributes do they need to have to succeed in MLS?
For us, the biggest thing was leadership. And when we went out and signed Liam as a DP, it was obviously his ability on the ball, his ability to play as a left-sided central defender. We also knew that he could play as a left-back if needed. However, we brought him in as a left-sided central defender. And for us, it was the leadership aspects. It was the ability to control the tempo of the game from the back. It was the ability to play out from the back. It was all the nuances of the game that, you know, I think are invaluable to a team. The ability to compress and basically hold the line when needed and get the most out of the players in and around them. And I think at that stage, when we signed Liam, there was only one other central defender, and that was with that was at the DP level with the LA Galaxy. So for us, we put a lot of importance in that position. And the simple thought process was, everybody's spending money on the number nine. How do we expect to compete if we're not going to combat it in some sensible way? And then the evolution was, we were able to keep Liam as a TAM player. And then it was a matter of pairings. And what we wanted was a Mabiala type. Somebody that was big, strong, athletic, dominant in the air. Somebody that could do the dirty work a little bit more. And for us, it was about the pairing, and a lot of it about the personality of the players. And there's a lot of clubs that I do think have got done this very well and got it right. I think Seattle should take a lot of credit. And, you know, some of the things that we do as a club, we look at other clubs and what are successful, and then try and apply it to the way in which we want to do it. But it is a tough position, in all honesty, to get right.
What's the most difficult position in the league right now to fill, do you think?
For me, central defender. I do believe that, you know, you could go left back, you could go central defender, but for me, it's central defender. Looking at what the options are out there, who's in the transfer market, what the succession plan is in that position. For us as a club, that has been the hardest position to have a succession plan and options and a depth chart.
Can I ask you on the academy side?
Yes.
Whether or not this... I'd love to get your thoughts on where you stand, but I also am curious, as we hear kind of rumblings about perhaps open recruitment, these areas that teams have been limited to or dominant in, maybe going away, and it being a matter of, hey, come to our team because we have the best opportunity for you. Would that help the Timbers if you're able to sell on your club culture and your facilities and your coaching as opposed to being stuck in a smaller area? And where does the academy stand right now? Why don't we see more Timbers Academy players in the ranks?
So the first thing is, our homegrown territory is, I think, one of the two smallest in the league. And then you have to look at the demographics within that homegrown territory. Our homegrown territory does not provide enough options, enough talent, enough diversity for us to have an amazing academy. We can be sustainable, we can be successful, but I think the only thing the league can do is open up the homegrown territories. Some of the natural, you know, you look at overseas, some of the best players could gravitate to the best academies. But when you start to look at the markets and how many players are in each market, and then start to say, okay, Oregon has 60,000 registered members, coaches and players, and then you've got millions in other areas, the ability for us to go in and work with other players and bring those in and mix those with good young Oregonians, it would be incredible. It would start to drive a level of football in this game and start to provide, I think, more players with opportunities in which to progress and move forward. So the homegrown territories, I think should be changed. I think they should be a thing of the past. And then it's up to a club, like you said, to look at their culture, look at their plan moving forward. And should we have a stronger, better academy, you know, I think Merritt would be more than willing to start to invest more. But at the moment, it's a matter of having a good academy, looking at what can come out of the academy while minimizing losses. And when you start to look at the ownership is putting in, pretty much every ownership is putting in 1.5 plus million per year, that has to pay owners back over time. It can't be purely philanthropic.
Does that mean this league needs to be more of a selling league? We talk about this all the time as well, where, and we're talking about it with the Red Bulls in a sense too right now, as you look through that roster that's going to have a lot of interest. How can the league balance the international market with the desire to keep the quality on the field here rising at a rapid rate? How can you balance the two?
I think as you start to have more talent coming through the system, naturally there's not a holding place for all of the talent, and it needs to be sold. And I think if we do a decent job and we start to bring the best young players into the best clubs, and we start to look at what we're doing now and starting to add those extra players to the current group, there's going to be a surplus of good young players. And those good young players need games, and we need to look to sell them. And that doesn't mean that every single player has to go for 17 million. It means that maybe it's, you know, 1 million, 2 million, and we're giving players the opportunity to go overseas and starting to reinvest in the academy. So when you start to look at where we're at with the academies, we're still very young as a country in how we're developing players and how we're going about it. So it's important for all the MLS clubs to continue to follow this pathway. It will continue to get better. There will be more players coming through. There'll be more young Americans in MLS, and I do believe there'll be more young Americans going overseas.
Leave it to me to nerd out on soccer with you here, Gavin. There is a big game coming up Saturday, 8 p.m. Eastern, Atlanta, Portland. Fox, Unimas here in the United States, TV Sports, and TSN are your TV channels up north in Canada. What's the best part about this week for you? You've experienced it once before, and the worst. I know it's hard to find a worst, but there's got to be something that annoys you.
The best part is the season's still going. You know, it's at the end of every year, it's like, oh, I want another game. The world in my life doesn't feel complete unless you're getting ready for a game. So the good news is that we were joking about as a staff, hey, we have another game. Let's enjoy it. The worst part is the MLS timelines and having to try and get everything completed and turned around so quickly. And that would be the only part relative to playing in an MLS Cup game.
How would you...
next?
Sorry. Go ahead. I misread you there. Go ahead.
The next thing is if we can continue to evolve as a club and get better and look to host an MLS Cup one day, that would be phenomenal. I think trying to plan for all the travel and the logistics is a pain in the rear end as well.
How will you watch this game before I let you go? Where will you be? What sort of state will you be in emotionally?
Yeah, that's great questions. I will be with Merritt and his family watching the game, and there is nothing I can do to affect the game, so it's the worst thing possible. I think when everyone will say, back when you were playing, you felt like you had some control over the game. You felt that you could affect the game. In my position, it's sit back and wait and see, and I'll be a nervous wreck. So it'll be an exciting time, but also a nervous one.
8 p.m. Eastern, Fox, Unimas in the U.S., TVA Sports, TSN, pregame show on MLS channels at 6:30 p.m. Eastern from Mercedes-Benz Stadium, Atlanta United against the Portland Timbers. Gavin Wilkinson is the current GM and president of soccer for the Timbers. Gavin, thank you for your time, man. Whatever you need to do, get that voice right, okay?
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Big thanks to Gavin for sharing so much of his time with us. I wanted to make that more about life as a GM, about the league, than the game itself. But 2 cups in 4 years, that'd be a huge accomplishment for Gavin. I remember the Gavin out times. Those times are, I'm not going to say completely over, but mostly over, it seems, for Timbers fans. Let's go around the league real quick before we go to the mailbag. Jordan Morris, according to Paul Tenorio over at The Athletic, signs a massive deal, up to 5 years, averaging out to about $1 million per year. Jurgen Klinsmann is somewhere saying something about comfort zones, but I can't wait to keep
that
seeing
number
the kid play.
Yeah, number got me out of my comfort zone.
It did. It did.
He's a really talented player, but he's not young anymore, and he's had one really good year. And I'm not he's not even the best forward on that team, and I'm not sure he could play other positions at a high level. I was shocked at this number. Good for him. Get paid.
Yeah, the problem is for Seattle is he's on the last year. So 6 months into this 19 season, he could sign a pre-contract with somewhere else. So their hands are tied. The number they gave him, though, I don't know. Now, the problem is Jordan Morris still has a little bit of leverage on the world market of going to Germany, because you remember he's still young. So they had to give that number. But I think that's a contract that many of us in this room will be questioning if he's not scoring 12 to 15 goals a year regularly.
A lot of agents are going to look at that and say, ooh, I like that. For my client, who's a young American who had a good couple of years, Christian Roldan's agent, I have to imagine.
Daniel Shallowy's on $118,000 a year.
I'm pretty sure he just signed that,
right?
Too, before
so
this season.
So think about that, right? So what's he thinking?
Just point something out. We do want to give a bit of a hat tip to Seattle for rewarding a play. We might disagree whether he deserves to be rewarded that
much.
What
they reward him for?
That's another question. Mm-hmm. But a lot of teams around the league spend that money bringing new players in. And we always say, why don't you reward the players you have? And you might disagree whether he deserved that number.
Well, what's he being rewarded for? That's all I'm asking.
I mean, he was
about
a starter on two straight MLS Cup teams.
Right.
You know, the 2016, they won it, and he was a big part of that. 2017, mm-hmm. he played injured that whole season, right. And that was a really good Seattle
team. So you
team.
Go from 230 to a million?
No, like I said, I think it's a higher number than I would give him.
That million
but Bobby's
number,
right. He's
that's
getting
a,
rewarded
that's
for,
an average
for being
out
loyal.
Yeah, that exactly, and it's backloaded. Mm-hmm. So don't be shocked if they signed him to this deal thinking maybe he moves to Europe.
Yep.
And they don't fork out that money.
That's
so there's
speaking of somebody moving to Europe, Tyler Adams, we talked about that one. But the reports out there that it is a minimal fee. It's not free, as they've said in Germany, but around that 750K allocation point, a little bit frustrating. On this show, I know we always talk about setting bars because one sale begets another and you start to set a market. What do we make of those reports? Frustration.
I have no issue with it.
You're good.
That's what happens when you have a father club and a sister club around the world, which is why Man City.
How come that didn't happen then with Jack Harrison?
Because you have to ask and read football leaks and figure out why they needed to move the five. I don't know that. Why would they move that when you can easily get away with this? The world market number for Tyler Adams? Listen, let's say Bayern Munich comes in 8 months and says the number right now is $6 million. Right, that's what every scout, that's what every agent, that's what everyone talks about regarding Tyler Adams. So it's not as if everyone looks at it and says he's a $750,000 or $1 million player.
It's just the benefit of the relationship.
It's the benefit of Red Bull Leipzig and New York Red Bulls. And quite honestly, if that's one of the byproducts of doing this, they have every right to do it. I have no issue with it. I think Tyler Adams is on to bigger and better things. And I think Red Bull Leipzig understands that and says, you know what? We're okay if we move them on.
The question Red Bulls fans will have is that other money could have been used to spend on DPs.
It's going
to
be used anyways because it's the same club.
Exactly. But the question is, what is the budget? What are they going to be given? So they're going to be waiting and seeing, Taylor. They're going to wait and see what happens in January. If they don't make some big signings, if they don't invest, they're going to say, hold on, we just lost a guy that we spent the last 8 years developing that became the heart and soul of our club, and what?
I'm surprised you're not more annoyed by this for the good of MLS as a whole.
I don't do good of MLS. I haven't done it for the last 3 or 4 years, Bobby. Okay. If we're going to grow this league in the right direction, we have to do it based on each individual club. It cannot be based on a single entity the whole time.
But it's not single entity. It's the problem with if Andrew Carlton blows up next year, and Andrew Carlton is 19 years old, and Bayern Munich are looking at him.
They have to pay. They don't own Atlanta United. Guys,
but what is the benchmark?
No.
Don't we think that if Tyler Adams had gone for $6-8 million, it would have helped Atlanta United?
The
get
rest of the world already knows it's $6-8 million, Bobby. So they know if Zach Stevens 7-10, if Tyler Adams is in, it's 5.5 to 7.5 is what the number that people told me that any other club would have had to pay for Tyler Adams. Same thing's gonna be paid for Andrew Carlton. This is just because Leipzig owns Red Bull New York. That's the reality. And by the way, to answer your question, if they're going to spend $7.5 million on the next Kaku, they're going to do it whether they got that money from Tyler Adams. You follow me?
Yeah, I agree.
So they don't need to know that number because they're already in this pyramid of where they're going to do it. I think for us that analyze this and all that, yes, naturally you want to see a number. The reality is Tyler Adams is a $6 million player in the world market. Whether Red Bull Leipzig pays it or not, that's what he is.
Some other news to run you through real quick. Orlando chasing Iago Pikachu to go along with Yoshi. Sounders after Miguel Troco, a Peruvian left back. These are all just rumors at this point. Kyrie Shelton sounds like he's going to try his hand in Europe, supporting Kansas City with two forwards on the books, Diego Rubio and Christian Nemeth. And Zlatan appears to be staying in L.A. after talks with Milan broke down. Finally, though, Columbus training ground. The Arena District Stadium plans. More than $600 million is what they're saying could be spent on this mixed-use development, which would be anchored by a 20,000-seat stadium.
You see the renderings of
that
thing?
Oh, my God. I'm a like big it's stadium prawn guy.
Are you really?
Day. Yeah.
Still haven't learned
I've learned, but it's still
anything?
I still just want to drink it in, Taylor. I still just want to be like, what could
let
be?
Let your mind go a little bit, Taylor.
I have.
Look at
and
that
then
thing.
DC United shows up, and then we don't have that roof. And I know. Audi Field is arguably one of the best environments. If they put a roof on that thing, watch out. The rendering, go back and look at DC United.
I can see it in my brain right now.
Credit to Minnesota United for drawing and actually building exactly what you want.
It's beautiful. But look, you should go check out this news.
$645 million, the new owner has to fork over for the entire project.
Now, it's not just a stadium, though. You do have some real estate development there. So
It's $645 million to get into the project and to do the project.
Yeah, that
we'll
is
see what that
cost.
Council meeting says in about 14, 15 days.
Bruce Arena, apparently a candidate for the GM role. That's it for us. We're going to the mailbag. We'll be right back.
Fans, we want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email extratime@mlssoccer.com or tweet at Extra Time Radio with any comments, questions, or reactions.
Back on Extra Time Radio, driven by Continental in the green room, finishing off an epic MLS Cup preview with the mailbag 401-206-0MLS. That's how you get at us. Please text us. The voicemails we get are unhinged. Unhinged. There was one from last time that was just 5 minutes into the show, just ripping us to shreds, and I was like, oh man, this is gold, but I can't play it because there are just way too many four-letter words in this. So try to edit yourself just a little bit. I do want to give a shout-out to a listener out there, Lauren Norman. RIP Apollo, we are so glad you listened to the show and glad you enjoyed that Berhalter interview. I hope things get better in your neck of the woods. Greg Berhalter, by the way, if you haven't listened to the special, go back one episode. We had 20 minutes with the new head coach of the U.S. national team sitting down here in the green room. It was an illuminating conversation in a lot of ways. He is ambitious, to say the least, about what he wants to do. There is a question still about whether he has the players to do it. Taylor, your thoughts on Greg into the position? His hopes and dreams, he wants to play romantically, he said?
Which is all fine and well. I think Greg, let's take the narrative about the process out of it, and let's say Greg was hired 8 months ago and allowed to find himself at the international game to figure stuff out. Greg still would have been in the conversation. If they interviewed 30 people, Greg still would have been in the conversation and one of the final people. So let's get that clear. So the fans can stop the negativity about the process versus the negativity towards Greg Berhalter.
I do think it is interesting in you saying to get his feet wet at the international level because he won't really have that time.
He doesn't have it.
There
because
will
of,
not
because
be
of
time.
How ridiculous the process was. He doesn't have that now. What Greg will say one thing, and the one thing that stood out to me out of all the sound bites, and you guys did a wonderful job of getting him to sit down, and quite honestly, he was very forthcoming, more so than I thought he would be on his first day, but he has
Agreed.
To because the process has already been going on for 14 months. I digress. When you look at this, he's got to get results right away, but he also said you've got to have flexibility. When it's rained cats and dogs for 17 straight days and you're playing a World Cup qualifier in Guatemala and the grass is up to the middle of your shins, you could be as romantic as you want to be, but when you need to get a result and to find a way, it doesn't matter how romantic you are. And I think the flexibility and the ability for Greg to change what he romantically, to use his words, looks at the game and then realizes, I need to qualify for the World Cup. That's going to be the most difficult part for him. The other aspect is you can call as many games as you want of Columbus, and you can watch as many games of Columbus. Defensively, their teams were always a little bit out of sorts. You could create chances against them. As great as
Not this year. Not they were so much better this year.
Mm-hmm.
Defensively, they were awesome this year, Taylor.
In what sense? They were tied for fifth in goals given and goals conceded.
Chances given up.
Even expected goals were okay too.
Expected goals, they led the league. I thought they were awesome this year.
No, expected goals given up, they didn't lead the league.
Yeah, they did.
They were near the top.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, still, I'll still stand by it, though. So we go one off this year, right? So, goal is collectively over 6 years in Columbus.
Right.
You guys are sold on Greg Berhalter coaching a team defensively and looking at it.
I don't want to say I'm 100% sold, but I'm optimistic, yeah.
Okay,
I think his team pretty consistently got better over his time.
His interview with you guys, he said, what was the most important year of his career?
16.
Okay. And what was that? Why did he get so involved and look at 16?
Because he had high hopes and they fell flat.
Because defensively, he realized his teams aren't good enough. Mm-hmm. Now, those are his words. It's not my words. My only concern for this is you can romantically look at CONCACAF and say, we can play this way. And the ability to execute it it's often apples to oranges. And if he shows flexibility and a good understanding that this game may call for us just to be who we are, then I think Greg could have success. But if not, then you guys tell me. You guys still have the players. You guys tell me you're really optimistic about where the player pool is right now after watching the last 7 to 8 friendlies.
I have a hard time being sure about anything, to be honest with
you. Me too.
Optimism, pessimism, where I stand, I think that's the beauty of it finally just being over. I'm ready to see a team that has a coherent idea.
Which is massive, which if we're being fair to Greg, it's difficult over the last 7-8 friendlies to because you don't. And that's not a shot at Dave Sarokin.
It's not. What's he supposed to do?
Well, no, because the players know you're not the guy in charge. So
what's
now
he supposed
to do? But that performance in England, I'm sorry, guys. That was arguably one of the worst performances I've seen in a long, long time.
I mean, we sat in there for Club and Country and put our hands and just said, I don't want to see any more of this, and we aren't going to. 401-206-0MLS, new head coach for the U.S. national team, but MLS Cup is coming at 8 p.m. on Saturday, so we got to talk about that. Fox Unimas TV Sports TSN. Bobby, you let's see. You said, what was it, that Atlanta fans need to suffer?
Mm-hmm.
Was that what you said?
Yep.
Okay, so Jennifer says, until Bobby said Atlanta fans need to suffer, cue jaw drop, I was hashtag Team Bobby. After Doyle's empathy for our many heartbreaks, I'm Team Doyle all day. The pandering is very, very strong in that one. Jeb Hart says, the pain Atlanta has been through is beyond words. It is so much worse than losing. The Browns know they're bad and accept that, and there's peace in acceptance. Atlanta sports are almost always just good enough to give you hope, and hope is what crushes your soul, not losing.
See the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
See the doubt.
Tyler Rice says, thought the same thing when Bobby Warshaw said you have to suffer and feel pain. That's the life of a Georgia sports fan, Bobby. Atlanta is the first team to potentially break the chain of suffering. Russell Gaither, WTF is up with Bobby Warshaw saying that Atlanta sports fans need to suffer. What a stupid take. There are a lot of people like me that have supported all our pro teams here and have suffered enough. This means everything to us.
I love when fans come back and they're like, do you know how much my life sucks? Like, do you know how much I hate my life?
Sporting wise,
I mean, if you think about it, the Falcons have never won. The Hawks have never won. The Thrashers, as Taylor said, they came and they went and they didn't win while they were
there.
The
Braves won one, but the Braves should have won more.
Oh, my goodness.
Georgia football is like the England of college football, because they have this huge following, and they have a name brand, but they're nowhere near as good as they think they are, and they won once a million years ago.
But do they put it in the mixer?
They do. They absolutely put it in the mixer, unless they're playing Alabama in a big game.
So we finished it here. Michael Wilson, I listened to the show yesterday, guys, and I just want to say winning MLS Cup would mean everything to Atlanta fans. Also, a counter to the points on the show on December 3rd. I believe Atlanta United fans are as homegrown as any team's fan in the league. I grew up in Atlanta my whole life and suffered deeply through all the sports disasters, from all the losing in big games to multiple fling NHL teams to the utter embarrassment and betrayal of Michael Vick. It has always been brutal to be an Atlanta fan. But don't mistake our disgust for our professional sports teams for dispassion for sports. Some of the richest sporting cultures in the U.S. exist in the South in the form of our college football and college basketball traditions. The culture around Atlanta United is not unique to sports fans in our region. It's just unique to pro sports teams. And while that passion and enthusiasm does not depend on winning, we'll see, I believe that winning MLS Cup would be potentially game-changing for our city and our region. Because Atlanta is made up of much more than transplants or the Euro snobs, which I am not, Michael says, Atlanta is truly our city's team, and winning the big game could mean changing the pro sports culture in our city forever. So, Atlanta fans, you had your opportunity to come back at Bobby. I appreciate you for it. Mike in Arlington, Virginia has a question here, and I think it's a great one.
Wait a minute.
For one Taylor Twelman.
I just want to interject, like, about the South's pro basketball? College basketball?
Kentucky, Duke, North Carolina.
I guess Kentucky's
Florida there for a while.
Yeah, that's not the deep South, though.
You don't know the South, Matt. Just admit it. You don't know.
I was thinking about the deep South, right? Because he was talking about Georgia and everything, and it reminded me of 2004, when Georgia Tech made it to the NCAA final.
Oh, my God.
Anybody remember who they lost to that year?
Don't care. Nobody cares.
No, let him say it. I want Matt to say it.
Don't care.
Come on, you can.
Mike in Arlington, Virginia. This one I think is for Taylor. Michael Parkhurst and Jeff Lorenowitz in the Cup got me thinking, how good Would the 06 Revs be in the league right now? Twellman, Dempsey, Noonan, Ralston, the best D-mid in league history, Shalvey Joseph, Reese, Franchino, Kinsella, Dorman, Heaps, John, as well as Relentwitz and Parkey. True, they had minimal depth by today's standard. You can quibble with that if you want, but they would still be one hell of a starting 11.
06 was the question?
06.
So Clint Dempsey is still with us?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We would compete, but I'm not one of those old guys get off your lawn type. This league's completely different. Players like Joseph Martinez, Miguel Amaron, Diego Valeri, we would competed, absolutely would have competed, but we had, 13 guys, 14 guys. You need a little bit more depth, the academy. You know, you'd throw Diego Fagundes maybe in that because he was in the academy at that time very young. No, that was 06, actually. No, I'm sorry. I was thinking 08. I'm not sure. I'm not sure where we're competing.
I think you guys would be better set up for a playoff run than the regular season because you need 25 players to get through the regular season.
Yeah. Pat, there's a question. But take that team and add Wilfried Zahibo. That's making a run, no?
I'm still taking Chalry over Zahibo. Even Chalry at 41 years of age.
But then putting Claude Bielma and
Somi.
Antonio De La May, and we're in business.
Guillermo Hausch.
Oh. We could go.
No comment. My tweet spoke for that time.
We can go on that one. Tyler from Dallas. As a Dallas fan, I don't like either team in MLS Cup, but the way Diego Valeri beat us with his magic, that dude deserves an MLS Cup. Also, what the heck is going on at Dallas with the key folks leaving? Clavijo, Pareja, now Luis Muzzi is out. He's going to Orlando to run their soccer side. He had been basically Clavijo's right-hand man. We had speculated that maybe he would be in the running to replace, but FC Dallas right now,
Clavijo, if we're being, you know, he's dealing with, let's see.
For sure. That's a different
some real
case.
Issues and let's
different
hope,
case. Health issues
he turns
that I think.
The corner on
yes.
That. I've heard over the last 48 hours, Tab Ramos turned down FC Dallas. So I don't know. I really don't know. I think leaving for Orlando City may have something to do with Tab saying no. It's going to be very interesting to see what they do with that. Is that Luchi Gonzalez then? Steps in, but from what I've heard over the last 48 hours is that Tab, now keep in mind, I've reached out to Tab multiple times. He said he would get back to me, but when multiple people within the league are telling you that Tab has turned down FC Dallas, that's telling.
Does that mean Tab is going to be the coach of the Olympic team?
I don't know. And listen, I'm not sharing anything that I wouldn't share with Tab. But if Tab wants to be a coach, he's got these high aspirations. At some point, you've got to take the job.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with him being able to speak Spanish, I think FC Dallas is a wonderful opportunity for Tab to really get into it and to apply his trade and to look at his craft. But right now, it looks like Tab's going to say no to FC Dallas.
I'm really surprised by that.
All right, we'll end here. Kamchatka FC, a Toronto FC fan on Twitter. One of the highlights of last year's Toronto FC MLS Cup celebrations was Josie Altidore's speech at the parade rally, which, of course, we play on the show's intro.
It was awesome.
Yeah, it was incredible.
This is a good question. I know where this is going.
I think that was like the brown liquor special of celebration speeches. Question, who among the finalists is most likely to offer a gem of a quote like that if they win this year? So the question is, who's going to get the best speech stepping up to the podium after a parade? Who do you got?
I think it's going to be Joseph Martinez. The way he handled his second language in English yesterday for the MVP, I think he'll do something that just will be so innocent, but will be something we talk about for the next 10 to 15
minutes. Super memorable, yeah.
I just want to point out that Bobosi's going to get up there and he's going to be like, I accept this trophy, but let's not forget about all the horrible things going on in our country.
Yeah.
And he's going to make a point.
He's going to
hear for that.
You hold on. You really think Obobese is going to get the mic?
Hey, if he scores two.
Hold on. You guys really believe that? He's a good friend of the show. Mara Paulson isn't giving up that mic to anybody.
That's the obvious
answer. He's not
answer
giving up
who's
that
gonna,
mic
who's
actually,
to
that
anybody.
Was the obvious one. So I was sitting over here thinking like Giovanni Savarese based on the way he goes crazy on the field and he's got that fire in him, but no, it's Mara.
Because you know if Atlanta wins, Arthur Blank's going to be just straight calm, cool, collected. It's going to be meant. I just think it's Joseph Martinez for whatever reason.
I'm going to go
because Parker's isn't giving us anything
no,
worthwhile.
Probably not.
Jeff Lorenowitz isn't giving us anything
they
worthwhile.
They could. They just won't.
Brad could. Brad could. Gazan could.
Yeah,
Brett could. He might throw you a little.
Yeah.
He could be. He might throw a little curveball.
Yeah, Darlington and not him either. The big game, Saturday, 8 p.m. Eastern, Mercedes-Benz Stadium, Atlanta United, the Portland Timbers. You can watch it on Fox and Unimas here in the United States, TSN and TVA Sports in Canada. Sunday morning, we'll be dragging one Matt Doyle out of his hotel room bed to record a podcast. So look around for that sometime during the day. 23rd MLS Cup, it's on the horizon. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you real soon.